Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 7th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Bruce Berner. It's session number 98-6 and is titled Homicide Primer, a Simulated Law School Class. Let's listen in.
Food. More today I'd say it's sharp. It may not be rude and everybody understands it's part of the process, but it's a rather sharp kind of cross-questioning that goes on in the class, and something which would not be appropriate for this kind of meeting.
Yeah. Is the National Bar Association, is there such a thing as the National Bar Association? I mean a loose federation of all the state bar.
Well, there's an American Bar Association.
That's right,
yeah.
Are they satisfied with what appears to be a burgeoning number of attorneys, more so than it used to be, or am I wrong in that assumption? Are there more attorneys than necessary?
Yeah, I mean, that's a large question. A lawyer would say, of course not. I guess the question is, how would you measure such a thing? Mm-hmm. We noticed that starting in the late 80s, it was more and more difficult to place students mm-hmm. in a job they wanted, which was a strong suggestion that there was a glut in the market. Mm-hmm. For 4 or 5 years after that, the enrollment in law schools was record numbers. And it was fueled by a lot of different things. A kind of a down economy, which always helps law schools, because they come out of college, they get a job, they go to a job. They can't get a job, then they say, well, maybe I can tread water for 3 more years here. So it's not like grad school where people make up their mind ahead of time they want to go to grad school. Law school sometimes was a default option for a lot of people. Consequently, we had a lot of people, but some of them had a very soft interest in it to begin with. And if we brought, say, 160 people in as first-year law students, in those days you could count on 8 leaving the first week because their commitment was soft and they saw immediately, uh-oh, this is not going to be easy, and so they would go away.
Yeah, I have personal acquaintances with that old 4 or 5 young gentlemen who are, they've graduated in the top 20% of the
right.
class, and they're just being hired on by CPA firms.
Yes. It really does depend where in the country you are. Some places the market is better. Some places the market is very tight. Law enrollment now has been down over the last 3 years into the law schools. And the way these cycles work, pretty soon people are going to be crying for them because there's not going to be enough coming out. Lawyers have been very good at creating new work for themselves, too. In other words, there's a big market now overseas for people with American legal education, both on the Pacific side and in Europe. Plus, we have a lot that leave with a law degree who don't practice law. They go with companies. They go with other kind of firms. They go with the government.
Does Martin have a law degree?
He does indeed. He does indeed. I would say every year we average having 2 pastors come to law school. They've gotten their pastoral training first. Now they want a law degree. We'll have 3 or 4 nurses, 2 or 3 policemen. Those are the kind of... Yes, sir?
2 or 3 decades ago in law school.
Oh, hold on 1 second. I better say roll the tape here. This is like a Pirandello play. You can't really tell when it starts.
No. 2 or 3 decades ago, law schools routinely eliminated half the students. But now everybody graduates. Maybe not. Why
right.
the difference?
Well, you're absolutely right. When I went to a law school in the 1960s, law schools around the country were practicing what was, for the most part, open admissions. If you had a college degree and you wanted to go to law school and you had the money, you got in. Consequently, the pass rates were very low. I started with a class of 67 and graduated 28. And that was all academic attrition. That wasn't economic attrition. Those were just people that washed out. But the competition over the last 15 to 20 years to get into law school has been so harsh, the line gets pushed up and up and up. Many people can't get in at all. The ones that do get in, we predict almost all of them ought to make it. And so our academic attrition rate over the last 15 years has been about 8%. So it's been, and that's been true across the country, much lower attrition. Better students to begin with.
The law schools don't consciously limit the number of lawyers they produce in relationship to the need.
No, we don't, but we limit it in terms of space that we can accommodate. There's a maximum number of students that you can accommodate. What happens is when enrollment is larger, when there's more people in the pipeline, then the people that you let in have higher credentials. So what really shifts is the quality. We can't shift the quantity, and right now we're operating about 20 short each year because we just can't get them. Understand that law schools are sort of in tiers. And so the very best students, there's about 10 or 12 law schools where the very best students want to go. And so we know that they're going to have a full class. I mean, Harvard, let's be honest, Harvard's not going to be hurting for law students. But it's the next tier down where our school falls in that great group in the middle where, you know, when the numbers fall off, we feel it. Let's, at the end of the session, come back to that, and I'm happy to talk as much as you want, some general things about how law schools work and what the market looks like. What I wanted to start with, at least today, was to give you just a little bit of a glimpse into what a class in law school might look like. I've picked, tried to pick a subject matter here, which I think is of general interest to people. At least, if you read the newspaper, or if you watch the television set, or if you watch crime drama on TV, homicide, of course, is we know the most serious of the crimes that we deal with today, and is certainly the most newsworthy. And so, what I'm going to try to do is to give you just a little bit of an insight into some of the jargon, and in the course of that, maybe give you an insight into some of the history. I said on the program notes for this that we would resolve ourselves into a class, and you would act as the students, and we can do that a little bit. I did say minus the rudeness, and we were talking before some of you came in, that law school class is Socratic, therefore it is very conversational, and it sometimes gets fairly sharp. That is, if someone takes a position, they're challenged, sometimes in a way that might not be called totally polite, to defend that. Law school is, however, today 100 times more humane than it was in the 50s and 60s. In the 50s and 60s, you've all maybe seen Paper Chase, where when Johnny couldn't get the answer right away, the teacher would flip him a dime and tell him to call his mommy because he couldn't stay. That was pretty rude. That was a pretty rude way to sort of get into somebody. You better study harder. We don't do that anymore. We don't do that anymore for a lot of reasons. First of all, we want them to stay because our budget, frankly, is being driven by their staying, so we don't want to drive them all away. It's also been driven by the fact that in the 50s and 60s, you might get one woman in a law school class. You might not. But now it's 50-50. First of all, the women students are, by and large, better. They study harder, and they therefore make the men study harder. They also make the men behave a little better. Talk to somebody, for example, at Notre Dame, the experience before they permitted women and after they permitted women, and they will tell you it's a totally different place, and most of them will say it's a better place. I think what we're going to see over the next 20 or 30 years, some major changes in the way law is practiced. A lot of that will be traceable to the fact that there are more women in the profession. We're already seeing a move away from a resolution of disputes, which was always adversarial, one-on-one, a winner and a loser, and we're seeing more and more ways of doing things that involve mediation, alternative disputes, where we try to reach a resolution in which everybody's a winner. And the women who are my colleagues at the School of Law in Valparaiso will tell you that's good and that's right. And not only is it good, but that we've been wrong for hundreds of years while the men were running the business. And so they're beginning to teach us a little bit on how to rethink some of these things. So it'll be different from a regular class in that way. It'll be different from a regular class in that I did not give you anything to read ahead of time. So law students will have read 4 or 5 cases for each class, and they will come in. Some teachers will say, you'll be doing the first case next Wednesday, you'll be doing the second case. then you know ahead of time and you can prepare. Some won't. You'll just walk in that day and you better have all five because you don't know whether you're going to get called on to do one or not. And that's a debate among teachers about which works better. I think it has more to do with the teacher's personality than anything else and what that teacher is comfortable with. So that'll be different. So since you haven't read cases, we're going to work from some hypothetical cases here instead. The other thing is when I teach them homicide, and this comes up in the first year course in criminal law, I have 15 class periods within which to do it. So 15 times 50 minutes. What we do then is instead of starting with any vocabulary or doctrine, we'll just start with a case. In fact, what most law students experience the first week, which makes them so nervous, is they open a book and they read of some dispute in England in 1732, written in what to them is almost a dialect, about a dispute that they could care less about. And they go, oh, we didn't think it would be this. We want to, like, study American law. And we just say, be patient. It came from somewhere. And so doctrine ends up in law school getting built up from the bottom. It comes up out of cases. We don't have time to do all that work to bring these principles up, so we're going to start by putting a few in play and then working with those with some hypothetical cases. Elements of crime. If we take all serious crime, and I want to leave traffic and minor kinds of misdemeanors behind because they work differently, but all serious crimes have a set of common elements. You can look at any criminal statute, regardless of what the behavior is that's described, and unpack that statute into these particular constituent parts. The first element is act. Okay? There is no criminal behavior unless a person does something. Okay? So we talk about act, or in Latin, actus reus, the criminal act. In other words, the criminal law does not undertake to punish things that are purely mental. You can think anything you want and it won't be a crime. For a lot of reasons. One of the reasons is we can't figure out often what you're thinking about. But sometimes you tell us what you're thinking about. Even then, the law only responds to action. It considers your thinking your private sphere. You can do what you want. So there has to be an act. Sometimes that act will be described in the statute. It will say exactly what act you can't do. You can't go more than 35 miles an hour in a 35 mile an hour zone. That's the act, driving in excess of 35 miles an hour. What's the act, by the way, in homicide? What act is homicide? This is. Let me make this clear. This is a trick question.
Termination of life.
Is that an act?
Causing the termination of life.
How? Through what action?
There
are a variety of ways. And the murder statute, the homicide statutes, never tell you which act. That is, they don't describe the action. If the murder statute were going to describe action, it would read this way. Anybody who shoots, stabs, pokes, drowns, garrots, and smothers, we could have fun for this for a long time, right? Is guilty of murder. But it doesn't do that. We're going to see in a minute that what it does instead is define this particular crime not in terms of act, but in terms of result from acts. But nevertheless, we have to find an act in there. We have to find the defendant taking some action. The second one, which is the one we're going to spend the most time on, and what is absolutely characteristic of crime as we understand it, is there's no such thing as serious crime with just an act. There has to be an act coupled with what we might call a mental state. The original word is in Latin, mens rea, guilty mind. And the reason we keep it in Latin is because then we can shift the meaning of it as we go. Right? If you put it into English, people will catch you when you're shifting the meaning a little bit. So most scholars still talk about the Latin. You're going to see in a minute that some of the mental states don't look terribly mental at all. But the point is, crime isn't just an activity. It's an activity coupled with a particular attitude or a particular intention or a particular knowledge. We'll talk more about that. The whole ballgame, by the way, is here. When it comes to differentiating one kind of homicide from another, all of those differences are going to turn on the fact that people have a different mental state that accompanies actual killing. Then we get a very technical element, which I'm not going to talk about, called concurrence causation. I intend to kill Bob, and I pick up a rock, and I hit Bob, but Bob dies of some other cause. I haven't committed homicide, even though I've done the act, even though I've had the bad attitude. His death is actually caused by some unrelated action. Homicide requires proof by the government that the defendant's act caused the death, and then the death is the result that has to be proved, the result of death. Those are all of the elements of homicide, and they're true for all kinds of homicide. Where we're going to develop all of the distinctions, and what happened historically was by differentiating the attitude or mental state that accompanied the action of killing. Was it intentional or unintentional? That was a major division. In fact, we can predict ahead of time that intentional killings are inherently different from accidental killings, and we're going to treat them differently and trace the history. The first kind of murder that was recognized, first kind of mental state or mens rea, was an intention to kill. Anyone who took an action which produced a death, if that could be proved to be with the intention to kill, that was the purpose of the activity, that person would be guilty of the homicide form of parole called murder. How do you suppose you would prove that someone intended to kill when they acted? How would you think?
Went and bought a gun that afternoon and shot someone an hour later.
Okay, so what you would do is you would infer their intention from their action. So there is a powerful dynamic that goes on between the act and the mental state. Not only do we have to prove that both existed, but sometimes the proof of one actually comes out of the proof of another. If you would watch Bob walk up to Bill and go, "You dirty," boom, would there be any doubt in your mind that he intended to hit him? Would you have the slightest doubt that this was accidental, that he was actually swatting at a bug? No, when you watch the activity and have it described, especially when we couple it with that language, right? We know immediately. Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, even a dog knows the difference between being stepped on and being kicked. It's different. We feel it differently. When people say things to us that offend us, it's very different when we know that that was their intention from when we think they've just been careless with the way they've spoken. We take it differently. You know, there's more hurt to it. It's a different animal. Most of the time, the only way we prove people's intentions is through what they do. Now, sometimes they help us. Sometimes they tell us, "I'm going to kill you." And that's announcing it ahead of time. Sometimes they announce it later to the police, right? They confess. Or they state to a friend, "I killed him and I did it on purpose." But still, very powerful dynamic between the act and the mental state. Intention to kill. What followed almost immediately upon that was another series of cases. In fact, the first case was an old case in England, and what they did was they got this guy who obviously this crowd didn't like. And I think you'll see in a moment the proof of that is pretty clear. They didn't like him. They made a bed of hot coals, and they brought him in and they lashed him down to this bed of hot coals. And then they poured some kind of accelerant on it, I imagine something like gasoline, to create a little bit of a fire around it. So he's now not only on the hot coals, but this is being accelerated through some kind of fuel. And after an hour of this, he died. They were tried for murder, and they came in and said, "We didn't mean to kill him." Now, there's a couple of ways you can go with that. One way that a jury may go is to say what? We don't believe you. We believe you did mean to kill. And we can infer an intention to kill from your action. What the judge said to the jury in that case is, you may find that they intended to kill this man. This is called Arrington's case, a very famous case. And if you find they intended to kill him, you can convict him of murder because we already have this idea here, intent to kill. But he said, let me tell you what, I think you can find him guilty of murder even if they didn't have an intention to kill, if what they had was an intention to do grievous bodily harm or serious bodily harm. So here's a judge saying, and this is how law school works. You start with one principle. Along comes a case now which doesn't quite fit it, but it seems to partake of the same basic idea, and then the doctrine begins to expand to accept that. So Arrington's case then stands for the proposition that if you act with the intent to do serious bodily harm or grievous bodily harm, and you know how they define serious? Wonderful. They define serious as the kind of harm which carries with it a high likelihood of death. We don't mean serious, it causes a lot of pain. We mean serious in the sense that it has a death sort of embedded in it as a real possibility. So murder then, at that point in time, becomes either an intent to kill or an intent to do serious bodily harm. Now some very odd things begin to develop. At one point in England in the common law, there were about 8 felonies, and when I tell them to you, you'll know, you've heard them all: robbery, rape, theft, burglary, right? And you know what the penalty was for them? You might want to guess, say, in the 16th century, what the penalty was for those felonies?
Death.
Death. Fraud. Larceny? Death. Robbery? Death. Burglary? Death. Law works. It's interesting. Here's this self-defense thing kind of written with these words that meant one thing for 2 or 3 centuries. You bring a new sort of set of facts to it, and if it's going to work at all, you have to let those words take on the kind of character that will support the new application. And so the states are slowly coming around that. Where would you suppose we would see the legal changes first? Of all the 50 states,
California,
right. When you were back in the 50s and 60s, it was always New York, Illinois, and sometimes Massachusetts, because they have a great tradition there with Oliver Wendell Holmes, etc. But now it's California. And you never know, of course, with some of the California decisions, is this the beginning of a trend, or is just another kooky California decision that'll a year from now they'll retract it? Yeah.
But is that a difference in the style of the people from California, or the difference in the roots of the origin of the people, Spanish law versus English law?
It may be some of that. I think it has more to do with the quality of the judges and the judicial system there. They California, with a man named Roger Traynor, who was Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court, powerful, powerful jurist. Why was Massachusetts big for so many years? Oliver Wendell Holmes. And that whole tradition, and then others followed. So sometimes it's pretty serendipitous, and it depends on one or two judges. Also, California is a very, very, very big state population-wise, and so they generate 10% of the litigation in the country.
But there used to be some very big differences, common law types of things.
Yes. The only state where that's really now sort of out of line is Louisiana. And Louisiana, it really is still under the old civil system, Napoleonic law, etc. In fact, we have Louisiana to thank for many of our constitutional rights, because for a lot of times, it took Louisiana for us to decide that the Sixth Amendment means you have a right to a jury trial, that you're federally protected to have a right to a jury trial. We did that in 1968. Can you believe that's how long it took? Why did it take that long? Because every other state's state constitution required it. They did it as a matter of course. But Louisiana didn't. And so Louisiana is sort of this... it fuels a lot of Supreme Court cases because... Now, what the criminal law won't differ much in California. What will differ in the states that have those civil roots is the way property is understood. Because community property as an idea of understanding property is very different from the common law method of dealing with property. So in matrimonial things and property divisions, yes, that'll be different. Criminal law won't vary very much in California from say, Illinois. What about our friend in the restaurant, who was hurt not just insulted, but badly hurt physically by this person, and now shoots him on the way out. You're right that self-defense doesn't work there, because the shooting there wasn't defensive. It was retaliatory. Right? And self-defense requires that you offer the force in defense of your own self. That's not happening in that case. So, should we convict him of murder? Anybody in favor of that? In favor of murder?
And what happens if he would have shot him after he was first hit on the hill?
Might be, yes. If he can get that force in close enough, if he's first hit on the head, and then it looks like he's going to be hit again, then he might be able to use self-defense, although even there, we require that when people use self-defense, they use a reasonable amount of force. So if someone slaps you and then they go to slap you again, an AK-47 is too much force, right, to defend yourself.
Unpremeditated? Would you say this is unpremeditated murder?
Yes, it's certainly unpremeditated. Absolutely. So there's no... Even though there might be an intention to kill, that intention is formed and then acted on almost immediately. So there's that difference, that this appears to be an impulsive act as opposed to what we might call a compulsive act. The interesting thing, though, is we can get some impulsive killings where there's no excuse at all. I walk around the corner and there's a guy with a red shirt. I go, red shirt, boom! You know, I didn't premeditate that. But my reason for killing him doesn't seem to come up to the level of the reason of this guy in the restaurant who's hitting me over the head. The distinction you make, Mark, we're going to take in a minute, that's a distinction that goes this way. And that's the next sort of major division.
Would they ever take into consideration justification? I mean, say, for example, A hit him, hurts him. He threatens A's family as well. A's all upset, pulls out the gun and shoots.
Yeah, if he can bring that within a theory of self-defense or a theory of defense of others.
But he's walking out the door.
Yeah. That's usually why you won't be able to get it inside those defenses, because they will be defined in such a way that require you wait until the force is imminent. If someone says, 10 years from now, I might hurt your brother, you can't blow him away, right? Because you have to wait till the force is imminent. That's been the classic rule. What the court said when it got this is, we're not happy acquitting this guy because retaliation doesn't look to us like self-defense. On the other hand, if we call it murder, that's the death penalty. We're not real happy with that result either, because we begin to identify with the person who is attacked in the bar. We don't condone the killing. We don't like the killing. But we don't like the penalty for the only crime that we had at that point to describe that activity, which was murder. So, what's the middle ground?
Manslaughter.
Manslaughter. You begin to develop a theory of a different kind of killing. Notice, everything else stays the same. The act, the concurrence, the causation, the result, they're all there. All that changes is this mental component. Why did the person do it? And we get this strange mixture of intent and motive. They're not the same thing, but they sometimes mix together. And so we come up, or the common law comes up, with this intermediate crime called manslaughter. And one way of defining manslaughter is murder without the death penalty. That's really what they were looking for, is a way to get a homicide conviction, because it wasn't self-defense, but they didn't like the penalty structure of death, and so they called this manslaughter. As a matter of fact, they called this voluntary manslaughter to signal that it's still an intentional killing. We're going to see another form called involuntary manslaughter, which is a very different breed of animal from this. And then they described voluntary manslaughter as an intentional killing in the heat of passion under severe provocation. So there's your instinct, Mark, of this sort of impulsive, it's a passionate response. A lot of rules immediately built up around that. the provocation had to be serious enough that a reasonable person would see it as a serious provocation. So if someone came in the next day and said, I don't like your blue shirt, boom, manslaughter, please, the court would go, oh, no. It's not enough for you to say, I felt inflamed, I felt passionate. The provocation has to reach the point where an ordinary person would say, boy, yeah, I can see, I'm somewhat sympathetic now to his reaction. Okay? So the provocation had to be sufficient. And the other thing is, if you were going to commit voluntary manslaughter, you had to do it fast. Because the whole idea was you're acting out of passion, not judgment. And so the courts developed this theory called the cooling off period. Once the cooling off period runs, then the killing becomes murder again. Picture our friend at the restaurant, hit over the head with the beer, blood coming down, goes to the hospital, get fixed up. 2 days later, he says, boy, that guy in the restaurant that did that, I'm doing a slow burn here. Let's find him. And he finds him and he goes in with a gun and he shoots him. Does he get voluntary manslaughter? No. No. Part of the theory here is that if part of the punishment or one of the purposes of punishment is to deter people or prevent people from acting, when is it the hardest to prevent people from acting? When they're not thinking. When they're acting from passion. You know, they're driven to it. It's hard to speak to people under those circumstances. And so we develop voluntary manslaughter as a kind of an offshoot of intentional murder with a lesser penalty. All of that is driven by the fact that we don't think the death penalty is appropriate for even all intentional killings.
Bruce, I have a question. Can you infer simply from the fact that the guy that was shot dies, that's the result, that was the intention? I mean, what if the guy says that he wanted to deliver a quid pro quo at a distance? He couldn't hit him with a beer bottle. He didn't have a gun. What he meant to do was to injure him, but
right.
Not even SBH, just to,
right.
You know, hit the guy in the leg or something. And but he's an apt. His aim is bad.
Right.
He winds up killing him.
Right.
Does that play in here at all?
It does. If we're persuaded by his argument, we may want to treat him down the bottom half of the board, which is unintentional killings. But because it's so hard to tell, another rule developed early on that said this. If you use a firearm and aim at any part of the body, even the feet, we're going to call that intent to do serious bodily harm because the ability to control the aim is so tight there. So an early rule developed that any intentional shooting at the person, any part of the person, would be dragged into serious bodily harm.
But if he throws a beer bottle at him and it happens to kill him, that's a different thing.
Correct, because now we can't infer either an intent to kill or an intent to do serious bodily harm. Where that case will end up is under an involuntary manslaughter. Right. Talk about that in a minute. The next development up here is there came a time where the courts and the public as well, presumably, were not comfortable even with all murders getting the death penalty. And so what they did was then they took what we used to have here and they split it off. And this is a purely American development now. We're done with England. The rest of this is all in America. And now they degreed murder into first degree and second degree murder. That was done solely for the purpose of isolating what kind of murders would get the death penalty. All of the rest would get life in prison, and today we're going life in prison without parole in many states as well. Okay? The way they divided that, and this goes back to Mark's comment before, is they took the intent to kill and they divided it into what was called premeditated killing and unpremeditated killing. And the premeditation was an element that aggravated the killing and made it first degree. What's the difference between regular old intent to kill and premeditated intent to kill? How would you try to describe that?
Planning.
Huh?
Was there any planning involved?
Planning, right. So planning, time, reflection. Well, there were some unfortunate early statements in cases by judges whose language got a little flowery, who said you can premeditate in an instant, theoretically. Oh yeah, theoretically. The problem is, in all of these cases, there's an intent to kill. That is, at the moment the gun is fired, the knife is wielded, at that moment there's intent to kill, but premeditated means it has gone back in time. In fact, the statutes always tended in America to read this way. Any killing which is deliberate, willful, and premeditated, as by lying in wait or poison. In other words, they pull out two descriptive types. Can you imagine trying to kill someone with poison passionately, hurriedly? What? What? You? Drink this! It doesn't work. It's got to be careful and planned and long, right? And lying in wait are the same kind of thing. In fact, probably the best way, anybody think of any real colorful words that you've heard used to describe this kind of killing?
Getting whacked.
Huh?
Getting whacked.
yeah. But to describe the mind of the killer who kills this way, where it's compulsive rather than impulsive, where you get this sense of brooding. A lot of ways to talk about it. Lying in wait's a nice image, right? Plenty of time to think. Ambush. How about cold-blooded as opposed to hot-blooded? A nice metaphor, right? Cold-blooded killer. What does cold-blooded mean? I think it means something like this. They plan it. They're careful. They wait it out. This here, the blood is always hot. Sometimes for a bad reason, don't like your shirt, we'll keep it here. Sometimes for a better reason, you hit me over the head with beer bottles for a half hour. Sometimes for a great reason, in which case, I have a complete defense. That's the whole spectrum, then, of intentional killings as they develop from the early English common law to here. Notice, always the differentiation depends on what's in the head of the killer. Never anything different about the axe. We'll find knife killings all the way across the board, gun killings all the way across the board, all kind of other things all the way across the board. Yeah.
Could you elucidate briefly about killing a burglar in your house in the middle of the night? I'm never clear on that business. It's legal, and should you do it?
Usually there the problem is not with any of this. This stuff is all clear. There's an intention to kill there. It's with the defense of dwelling. And it has to do with what does each state do in terms of defining how much force you can use to protect your dwelling. The trend now is this. The common law had the biggest problem with dwelling. They knew you could defend your person or your family, other human beings. They knew you could defend them even up to death if necessary. They knew that you could never use deadly force to protect your chattels. Better he gets away with my marking pen than that I kill him, right? Or my Sony, or whatever it is, my car, whatever. So it was real clear you could not use deadly force to defend mere property. Dwelling was the one in the middle. The home was the one that the common law had a great affinity to. As a matter of fact, two crimes that are major felonies can only be committed against the home. Think what they are?
Arson.
Originally defined as the intentional burning of the dwelling house of another. You couldn't commit arson on a bank, much as you might want to, right? You can now, but the earliest version of arson was dwelling house was right in the definition. And the other one was
burglary,
right? Which was the breaking and entering of a dwelling house at night with the intent to commit a felony therein. Boy, you took, well, that's a lot to prove. Had to be at night, too, at the early common law. What most states say today is ordinarily you can defend your dwelling with the use of deadly force, and one of the reasons, because there's almost always self-defense and defense of others in the picture, too. Can you name me the kind of case where there isn't self-defense or defense of others in a burglary situation?
When they're on their way out the window.
Well, but you're there. He still might attack. He might turn and attack.
when you walk in and they've like broken into the house and you just walk in the house and feel away from it.
Right. So you sort of surprise them. That's when the danger is at its highest. But part of the danger now is to you. Can you imagine a case where you might want to defend your dwelling where you are not in any danger, nor are any members of your family in any danger whatsoever from that person?
Those situations where somebody rigs a shotgun.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The device cases, the so-called spring gun cases. No one is home. No one is going to be home. And they set up some kind of a trap gun so that anybody who opens the door gets it in the face, right? Those are the cases that put the greatest pressure on defensive dwelling because it's pure defensive dwelling. There's no people there to argue self-defense about. And what I would say there is about two-thirds of the states will permit that, and about one-third will not. The model penal code will not. The model penal code says there has to be people around, but, yeah. Okay, so I think you get some kind of a sense now of this run of intentional killings from the worst kind to the best kind, all coming out of the history, by the way, of how we felt about the death penalty. So long as we had a view that every crime gets the death penalty, none of these distinctions would have mattered. We make the distinctions for purposes of making different kind of penalties. This, by the way, is beginning to change now. We're beginning to do this not in terms of legal theory, but in terms of sentencing theory. That is, first-degree, second-degree distinction is starting to die, and we're doing that in another phase. But this is very much the classic American position. Now, we get another... let's see. Rather than do that...
Yeah, actually, a question. There's a robbery, the robber doesn't have a gun, breaks into the house...
Right.
The homeowner does have a gun and shoots him.
Yep.
Now,
usually that'll be a complete defense.
That's complete defense.
Right.
Okay.
I'll give you one, though. Robber goes in the house. Well, let's not have him in a house. Let's have him in a store. Okay?
Okay.
Let's make it a 7-Eleven because out East Coast, they're a great target. Okay? 7-Eleven says, please rob this store. That's sort of what it must say, given the statistics. Convenience stores get hit all the time because there's usually not a lot of help around, and there's usually a fair amount of money in the till at certain times of day. You're going to think I'm making this case up, and I'm going to tell you I can find 50 of these in the books. Robber walks into the store, give me all your money. Clerk pulls out a gun, shoots at the robber, misses the robber, kills some guy down back there looking at the Twinkies. What's the result? The robber is guilty of murder. Not the clerk. The robber is guilty of murder. And that's a theory that we have down here, which is called felony murder rule. A felony murder rule, you may hear about that... murder one of those crime drama cases, love to play with the felony murder rule. The felony murder rule says if you're committing one of the six inherently dangerous felonies, burglary, arson, rape, kidnapping, robbery, and attempt at any of those, and a death is caused, you committed murder, even though you may not have pulled the trigger. In some of these cases, the police pulled the trigger, shooting at the robbers, hit someone else, robber's guilty of murder. Here's another one. A and B are a team. They're conspiring to rob. They go and they rob the store. Clerk pulls out a gun and shoots A dead. B is guilty of the murder of A because he caused it. And it's pretty clear he caused it. I mean, this clerk didn't pull out the gun and shoot down every third customer. That's not very good for business, right? So it's only the robbery that's producing that. So that was murder. That was a type of murder that developed that was unintentional. Because in these cases, the people committing the felonies had no intention of producing a death. They had an intention of committing a robbery, but not a death. But this rule changes it. Let's work with some of the hypotheticals here on the green. I'm not going to talk through the bottom of the pink chart because we're running out of time. Well, let me see what you do with the first couple of these. First, V, without provocation, attacked D in a bar and beat him severely. D drew a gun and V turned and ran for the door. D aimed at V's legs, witnesses verify this, and shot. V was struck behind the knee and fell headlong into the brass doorknob and died as a result. What is the most appropriate crime, if any, to convict D of? And I wanted to read this one. Why? Because you people have already put this hypothetical on the table, right? It's a fairly natural one. And once you start this stuff, you know, if you were to take all of the things that law students said in class as we work through this, what two words start 80% of their sentences?
What if?
What if? That's the what if game. Oh, okay, I understand that, but what if this? What if he's 8 foot tall? What if she's married to him? You know, in other words, they immediately want to bring in other facts. And why is that important? Because that's what tests the rule. What tests a rule is to put cases up against it to see if the rule works, or to see if the rule fails, or to see if you have to give the rules some tentacles and some qualifications. Okay. All right, so that's the first one. And where that one would come out is that would be voluntary manslaughter because of the retaliation and the severe provocation. And it would be a voluntary manslaughter based on intent to do serious bodily harm. Even though there may not be an intent to kill, shooting at the legs, it turns out, is very clearly classified as serious bodily harm. Now, two gives you three rather odd ones, although this happens more often than I think you might guess. D, with no provocation. So we get this link. So that's code word for the law students. Not going to be any voluntary manslaughter here because there's no provocation. We're going to be over here or maybe over here. D, with no provocation, shoots at X with the intent to kill. So at the very least, it's starting out to look at least here. It could be here if we have premeditation. We don't have enough facts to know if we have premeditation. Doesn't sound like it, though. He misses X, but hits his own friend Y, killing him. What crime? Uh-oh. Right? The first time the law had this case, the official response is, uh-oh.
Is that felony murder?
No, it's not, because that's a good instinct, though, to use that rule. The problem is the felony murder rule only worked with burglary, rape, kidnapping, arson. Homicide itself was not a root crime for felony murder. In fact, you know, when you say murder is not an inherently dangerous felony, the students look at you. What'd he say? But for this purpose, no. Well, now notice the law has a terrible problem here. If you say, well, let's get him for the murder of X, the problem is X ain't dead.
What's the difference between this and the 7-Eleven? What's the difference between this and the 7-Eleven situation?
That the felony murder rule is operating in the 7-Eleven case because there's a robbery going on. And so that's what triggers that other rule. So you can't get X because he isn't dead. You can't get Y because the defendant didn't intend to kill Y. Where's the intention to kill? But that doesn't sound right, does it?
Attempted murder.
Oh, yeah, attempted murder. You can get him for attempted murder of X, but, of course, the prosecutor wants more. We've got a dead body here. I'm running for re-election next year. I don't think the people who vote are going to be happy with attempted murder. No, actually, we're going to get murder out of this, but we're going to have to figure out a way to do it. This case reminds me of the joke. This guy goes into a grocery store, and he gets some grapefruits. And then he brings the grapefruits up to the stand, and the guy asks him for the $2, and he says, you know what, I changed my mind, I don't want the grapefruits, I'd like an equivalent value in bananas. Clerk says, fine. Clerk takes the grapefruits back, now puts the bananas there. The guy takes the bananas and starts to walk out. The clerk says, aren't you gonna pay? And the guy says, pay for what? And the guy says, pay for the bananas. He says, I gave you the grapefruit for the bananas. Well, then pay for the grapefruit. He says, I'm not taking the grapefruit. That's the problem here. Right? It's the problem here. He intends to kill one guy, but it's different from the one who dies. So for one of them, we say there's no death, so we can't get murdered. For the other one, we say there's no intent. And so the law developed a fiction here. The law developed a rule to put them together, and they called it the rule of transferred intent. We will take the intent to kill X, and we'll transfer it to the person killed. And so we will now, in legal jargon, say he did intend to kill Y, who is dead, by transferring the intent to kill X to Y. That's the so-called bad aim transferred intent. Yeah.
Did the law do that for that specific case, or did
yes.
it do it after the oh.
In the case that this raises it, they developed that doctrine. See, in other words, it's not developed ahead of time like legislation, which only applies prospectively. Common law development always means that it's developed in a particular case and then applied to that case.
Does a jury come up with it?
The judge does. No, this was purely judge-made law at this point. But
so a situation develops and then they develop a law during that situation and say it's wrong? That seems un-American.
That's because all this happened in Britain. And now the common law, your instinct is absolutely right. The common law tradition where rules can be changed during the lawsuit and applied to the people when they didn't know them ahead of time still is very much active today in civil cases. But when you get to criminal cases, then you get into a constitutional doctrine called ex post facto, or sometimes called the constitutional requirement of fair warning. So if someone does something today and you don't like it, you can't now make it a crime and then apply that to him ex post facto. There's always a line, though, where it's never clear whether we've made a new law or whether we've simply given a slightly new interpretation to an old law, which we might be able to apply retroactively. D is severely beaten by X. I always put severely in there to make sure that we drive home that this is enough provocation, ordinarily, to get to manslaughter. In retaliation but not defense, he shoots at X, misses him, and kills his own friend Y, killing him. What crime? Now, you ought to be able to get that based on everything we've talked about.
That's immediate retaliation?
Yes, but not defense. And we still have the same thing as we had in 2A. Someone other than the intended victim gets killed.
Is it voluntary manslaughter by the transferred intent?
Yeah, good. You just put things as two together. Now we got voluntary manslaughter via transferred intent. The first case was murder via transferred intent. Now we drop the. Now we add the provocation, which makes murder manslaughter, and the transferred intent doctrine works there. In other words, the rule, we say this: whenever you transfer the intent, you have to transfer it with all the baggage. Okay? And C is just the sort of final one there. X is attacking D. In self-defense, D shoots at X. Misses X and kills his own friend Y, killing him. What a crime. No, now we might even get self-defense. Complete defense. The only thing that we might find here is that there may be a different theory to get him for the homicide of his friend down here in the unintentional side on recklessness. Let me just kind of quickly fill this out for you. What we get down here is involuntary manslaughter is based on what we might call recklessness. And then we get up here something that we might call super recklessness. That is, there are cases, not many, there are cases where murder is made up from people who engage in conduct which is just incredibly stupid and risky. One of the first cases here is a case of a young man down in Tennessee who had a hobby, and his hobby was shooting through the windows of passenger trains as they came by his house. At some point in time, of course, he kills one of the passengers in the passenger train, and he says, "I mean to kill him." And he was, and the jury believed that. He didn't intend to kill him. He didn't intend to do serious bodily harm. He intended to miss everybody. But the court said, that's not just reckless. That's so reckless. It was another case of a guy who threw a baby out of the eighth-story window to see if it would bounce. Claimed to have no intention to kill or to do serious bodily harm. The person had a mentality which the jury may even believe that he didn't do it, but they still talk now about this sort of super recklessness. Yeah.
There was that case in Texas where the man was dragged to death behind a pickup truck. And could their defense attorneys claim super recklessness or involuntary because they didn't mean to kill him?
I think that the jury will find that they did mean to kill him. I think that's a case where we will probably, the jury won't have much trouble inferring from the conduct an intention to kill there.
So there's, if you get any above super recklessness, you start to get into the intentional level.
Yes, that's correct. And the other thing, of course, that we've got going in that case is a lot of states now are beginning to pass new legislation which really elevates the penalty for homicide if it appears to be based on hate. That is, if we get these sort of hate crimes, sure. Racial and class hatred. One more, and then I've got a...
Yeah, how about, say there's an overpass, a freeway going under the overpass. Somebody drops a rock or a block or concrete on the car, kills somebody
right.
in the car.
Right. Usually, usually it's teens that do that, high teens, 16, 17.
Yeah, right.
Usually those cases come out here, involuntary manslaughter. Sometimes they come out murder. If you can show, for example, if you have any facts showing that they really want to kill, sometimes they tell the police they wanted to kill, or they tell their friends, we're going to go kill a couple of drivers today at the overpass. So you may get cases where you get enough evidence that you can show intention, but usually those kind of cases end up here as involuntary manslaughter. Thank you all. Thank you all very much.
Wait, what does that mean? Then? Does that mean life imprisonment, or
no?
What's going to be the penalty?
It's going to vary by state. Most serious, next serious, but this still is usually this death penalty potential. Otherwise, life.
Right.
Life without parole. Probably here, depending on the state, either life or 60 years, something like this. This is shorter. This may be 5 to 20. Okay. And this may be 1 to 10. Thank you all very much. Thank you.